Welcome to the Westside Audio Message Podcast. We hope you enjoy today's message. And if you're looking for more ways to connect with Westside Assembly of God, feel free to check us out at www.westsideag.org. You'll find all the information about our service times, upcoming events, and opportunities for you to plug in and get connected with Westside Assembly of God. Additionally, you'll find a complete online archive of all of the previous and current messages absolutely free of charge. We hope you are encouraged by this week's message, and thanks again for downloading the Westside Audio Message Podcast.
We are going through the book of Genesis. If you've been with us, it's become quite apparent that's what we're doing several weeks now into this book, and only beginning the sixth chapter today, which is quite an interesting chapter. The sixth chapter contains a passage of Scripture that might be one of the most difficult passages in the entire Bible, and it unquestionably is the most difficult passage in the book of Genesis. So that's what we're going to be looking at today, and I'm going to begin reading in the first part of the sixth chapter of Genesis. And the Scripture says, "When human beings began to increase in number on the earth, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, 'My spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal, and their days will be 120 years. The 120 years is a reference to that time when God would send the flood of judgment. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only on evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord." This takes us down to Noah, down to the flood. We will do the flood next week. But this is quite an interesting passage of Scripture. As I read this, if you were tracking, it probably spawned several questions. First of all, before I really get deep into this, I want you to take particular notice of the language of this passage and how it mirrors the fall of Adam and Eve with the tree of knowledge, especially apparent in the King James Version. This is not accidental. It was purposeful on the part of the author, although you may have never seen it before, that the sons of God saw Adam and Eve in the garden. Eve saw the tree. The sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful. Eve saw the fruit, that it was pleasing to the eye. And they took the wives. Eve took the fruit. So you have the seeing, you have the attraction, you have the taking. And those elements fit both as the means, the recipe, the design by which this fall took place. This provides more evidence of one of the recurring themes that we have in the book of Genesis, and that is, it's the record of power and influence and devastation contained in sin. So we don't want to lose sight of this ongoing message in chapters 1 through 11, because this is really one of the reasons that the author designed the first 11 chapters as he did, is to trace the impact of sin. All these narratives that we're dealing with are exemplifying this is what happens when sin takes root. Now, we just finished last week, skimmed over the genealogies of Seth and Cain. And if you read them again, go back and just refresh yourself. That doesn't take long to read them. You will find that particularly in the genealogy of Seth, that Moses once again masterfully paints a picture of the blessing of God and how that blessing is constantly confronted by and impacted by the curse of God. And let me just point out some examples of that. Genesis 1:27, we go back and we pick up the declaration of God's blessing on Adam and Eve and on humanity. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And then God blessed them. Not just Adam and Eve, but he blessed humanity. And he said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. That's the blessing that God gave to humanity after creating them. That they would be blessed, they would be fruitful, they would multiply, and they would have dominion. Now, carrying that theme through the first 11 chapters, we see repeated reference to and evidence of the blessing of God on humanity. In the fourth verse of the fifth chapter, our first evidence of this says, after he begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years. Now, the begetting is the blessing. The blessing is apparent. Adam is now experiencing the blessing that God had pronounced on them, bearing children. And he had sons and daughters, the blessing. So all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. The curse confronts the blessing. You can't get away from that, what was set in motion upon the failure of Adam and Eve, that God had pronounced a blessing. The blessing wasn't lifted just because they failed. But the curse would always be there to truncate the blessing. Now, you can read the genealogy and see this repeated formula. I'll read a couple more just so you get the rhythm of this. After he begot Enosh, Seth lived 107 years and had sons and daughters. Identical wording. So all the days of Seth were 912 years. And he died. After he begot Canaan, Enosh lived 850 years and he had sons and daughter. Blessing. And all the days of Enosh were 905 years. And what? He died. You get it now. Blessing, curse. It becomes this rhythmic pattern in the fifth chapter as each character is said to carry out the blessing, experience the blessing of God, and it all comes to a grinding halt because the curse has brought death. The blessings of God in our life will always be impacted by the curses of this world. And if we don't remember that, we might get bitter. We might get confused. We might mistakenly believe that the blessings of God protect us from the curse. But they don't. It doesn't. The curse impacts everything. So I am grateful when I have the blessings of God in my life. And I'm somewhat confused when in the midst of the blessing, we have the curse raising its head. It's the ebb and flow of life. That we have the joy of God's blessing and the agony of the curse. And it never goes away. Now, if you had time to think about it, and I don't want your mind to stray away from what I have to present today, but if you had the time to ponder this, you begin to recognize those episodes in your life when things were going great, then suddenly everything comes crashing down. Why is this, God? It was all going so well, and then suddenly it's all interrupted. Blessing, curse. Our blessings are in the midst of a cursed world. And the curse interjects into the midst of our blessings. And folks, that's just the way it is. And you can't get discouraged and give up on living your life for God because you've got the rhythm of the curse and the blessings coming one, then the other, and sometimes at the same time. We just got to deal with it. But thank God for the blessings, because without that, the curse that we're living under in the midst of this world would be so miserable to have to try and deal with. That's what we glean from the genealogies that I didn't throw in last week, which gives us a running start into our passage today. Now, perhaps one of the first questions that pops into our mind as I read this passage is, what's this about the sons of God marrying the daughters of men? If you have the King James Version, there's other versions as well that say the same thing, when the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair. And they married them. Then we have to wonder, who are the sons of God? And there's popular theories on this, none of which are so convincing as to decidedly eliminate the other theories. So I'm not able to give you an answer with certainty, but I think it will be informative for you that I share the popular viewpoints. The earliest interpretation of this passage that we have any record of in Judaism, in the ancient Jewish beliefs, it was widely accepted that the sons of God were angels. And that view predominated until more than 100 years after the birth of Christ. And then, for the first time, we saw two other theories from that time on begin to arise concerning the identity of the sons of God. So the Jewish scholars began to advance the theory after the turn of the millennium, after the birth of Christ. Jewish scholars took a second look at that and began to advance the theory that the phrase of God, the sons of God, referred to rulers, dignitaries, leaders, powerful people. And the Christian scholars suggested that the sons of God were the line of Seth, and the daughters of men were the line of Cain. The angels' theory, though it had been substantial for centuries, fell into disfavor. And the line of Seth and the line of Cain theory became the most popular theory even to this day. Now, here's some arguments for all of those theories. For the theory that the angels are the sons of God, you understand what that implies now. Let's go back and take another overview of this passage. Sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair. In this theory, they believe the angels saw human women and decided to marry them, and the consequence, the fruit of that marriage, were men of great renown, giants. Here's what I'm going to do. Let's go quickly over to the book of Jude. Do you have a Bible with you? Well, good. Let's go to Jude. If you don't have a Bible, there's a possibility George may be able to quickly pull up Jude. I don't know if he can or not, because I don't know what you have to do to make these things happen, but he's good at what he does. If you do have a Bible, then we're over there, and I'm going to show you what Jude has to say. That the proponents of the angel sons of God theory love to go back here and make reference to this. And the angels that kept not their own principality, your King James Version, their first estate, but left their proper habitation, he hath kept in everlasting bonds under darkness unto the judgment of great day. Jude says there were some angels that did not keep their first habitation, their first estate. Jude says that whatever this was, these angels were especially imprisoned, not along with people in hell, but especially selectively imprisoned so that they could no longer do whatever they did. That's what Jude is telling us. Now, of course, the proponents of the sons of God theory fill in the blanks for you. Now, what's interesting is verse 7 says, even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them, having in like manner, that's an interesting phrase, having in like manner with these, given themselves over to fornication and gone after strange flesh, are set forth as an example, suffering the punishment of eternal fire. Interesting passage. Peter says in chapter 3, verse 19, I believe it is, if I knock the rust off of my memory banks, by the which he also went and preached to the spirits which are in prison. And the word prison is a special Greek word, tartaros, which people identify tartaros as not just hell, and certainly not the lake of fire, but there is a holding place that Peter talks about, spirits that are in prison. Now, all of these things give rise to a real interesting theory. And that is, these angels did something very heinous, and God imprisoned them especially and locked them up, said, you'll never do that again. Are these New Testament references to that? Well, we know one thing for sure, that the proponents of the angel theory certainly believe that that's what it is. Also, bolstering the angel sons of God argument is a lexical argument. Now, I don't want to confuse you with fancy terms, but it just means the usage of the term. So the phrase sons of God is only used, I think, four times in the Old Testament. One time here, the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair. Three times it's found in the book of Job, talking about the sons of God. You remember in the introduction of the book of Job that the devil went before the Lord and said, the Lord said, have you considered my servant Job? And the sons of God came to witness this whole interaction between Satan and God and the plot to challenge Job. That's where we find the reference to the sons of God. It is without question, as far as I think it's well established, everybody understands that the sons of God in the book of Job were angels. So a lexical argument is, if you find this phrase anyplace else in the Bible and it's very clear where that's found, what that refers to, then that weighs heavily in favor of the use of that phrase anywhere else. So not knowing who the sons of God are in the book of Genesis, you go to Job and you say sons of God are clearly angels. There's one other time that the phrase son of God is used, and that's in the book of Daniel, whenever the three Hebrew children were thrown into the fiery furnace, and they looked into the furnace and they said, I see the fourth man, he's like a son of God. We often misquote that and say, like the son of God. But they didn't have any concept of the Son of God in the Trinity, so that wouldn't have been something they would have said. But they did have a concept of angels, angelic beings. So he looks in and says, it looks like an angel, it looks like the Son of God. So sons of God used four times, Son of God used once, where it's apparent from the usage of that he's making reference to. It looks like an angel in there, an angelic being. That bolsters the argument of the sons of God. The problem with this theory is somewhere along the line in the development of our Christian theology, somebody came up with a definition for angels, a description for spiritual beings, and said it is, by definition, impossible for angels to procreate. Well, why is it? Because by definition, spirits can't procreate. Well, where's the definition? Well, it's theologically defined. Well, who defined it? Well, it's just the truth. And of course, I'll tell you where they do get that, and that is they came to Jesus and they asked him this complicated question about this woman that had several men step up to be her husband, because the man that was married to her died, and his brother then married her, which would have been Jewish custom that if your brother dies, somebody has to marry this woman, take care of her. And they came up with this convoluted scene where a series of men kept dying, and the next man keeps marrying the woman. Now, that would make me shaky to marry the woman. And then they come to Jesus, and they say, whose wife will she be when we all get over in glory? And Jesus said, well, the problem you're making, the mistake you're making is that things don't work in heaven like they work down here. And he said, they don't marry. They're like the angels in heaven. And the angels don't marry. So from that, they extract this thought, well, if angels don't marry, then evidently they cannot reproduce. I think there's a leap in logic there. I think when Jesus said they don't marry, at the very minimum, he was saying they exist without the necessity of having to marry. They exist in a place where you do not die, so there's no need to procreate and populate. And at the very minimum, he's saying that. But I don't see from that passage where he is for a fact saying they don't marry, therefore they cannot procreate. So I think there is an assumption there. But that is the argument against the sons of God theory. Now, the next one set forth by the Jewish scholars is these sons of God must be rulers. And they also base theirs on a lexical argument when they look at references to leaders being children of God. And it's not the exact phrase, but references to being of God. And the Jewish scholars begin to think, well, maybe this refers to rulers that are marrying common people, royalty, or leaders marrying lower echelon people. So the distinction between sons of God and daughters of men is merely basically royalty and commoners. And the attractiveness of this theory is it gives us this tidy flow of the progressive effects of sin upon humanity. Sin flowed from Adam and Eve to the family, to society, and then sons of God marrying daughters of men, sin flowed to the world, and the wicked world then was destroyed by the flood. One difficulty this presents is how to explain that the intermarriage of royalty with commoners was an offense to God. And there's another objection as well, but I'll bring it into the third theory. The third one is something that probably, if you've ever heard this taught on, you've probably heard this as the preferable theory, and that is the sons of God is the line of Seth, because we just got done with the genealogy of Cain, and you saw in there that the notable people of the line of Cain were wicked people. The notable events, when you pause and talk about this character, well, he did something that was wicked and offensive. And then you look at the line of Cain, and the notable people, the notable things that happened were commendable. They were righteous. Enoch walked with God. And so you tie the fourth and fifth chapters to the sixth chapter, and they say it's just obvious. It just makes sense that the sons of God now refers to the godly line of Seth, and the daughters of men refers to the line of Cain. And in many ways, that's an attractive theory as well. And one of the looser interpretations for this theory is that the daughters of men were not just the line of Cain, but they were anybody who was sinners. So they're even reducing this down a little bit further, that in those days, righteous people began to marry ungodly people. Now, if this were the true interpretation, then that would make a wonderful sermon for me. But I can't pursue it too far, because I'm not sure that that's the case. But if it were, and if you'll pretend with me for a minute that it is, then we might could make the case that chaos always ensues when the righteous marries in with the unrighteous. And there would be so many examples that we could think of today. As you see young people pondering and selecting their life's mate, and if they have any kind of a faith background, church background, whatever, and they marry somebody who does not, As a pastor, I look at those situations and I say, you are taking a huge risk. You are not giving your marriage the best opportunity you could possibly have for you to be complete, fulfilled, and happy. You have to choose from like-minded people, especially spiritually aligned with you. And part of the problem is, young women, generation after generation after generation, continue to make the same mistaken assumption. And that is, I can turn them in to the person I want them to be. Now, what you don't understand is young men will do anything for you when they are mesmerized by you, when they are in love with you. They turn into a totally different creature once you get married. When you're courting, it's like out of a storybook. It's like out of a fairy tale. This is the most wonderful man in the world. And this transformation that happens when they say, I do, suddenly they don't want to go to church with you anymore. They don't want to buy you flowers and cards and gifts. They don't want to do romantic things anymore. It all just kind of dissolves. It disappears because they've got you now. There's no incentive to woo you anymore. They've got you. And young women continue to think that I can turn this person because he'll do anything I say. I snap my fingers. He's right there. Yeah, he's wanting to win your heart. No wonder he's acting like that. And then once you get married, you find out you can't manipulate that man to be the godly man you envisioned you could make him to be. And I've seen some of the most awkward marriages resulting from people who purposely married outside of their faith. I even, in the church I grew up in, one of the ladies that was there from the very beginning when we established that little church, and through to the very end until she died, she was faithful. And she was a wonderful Christian. And her husband, as far as I know, was a wonderful Christian. But she was Assembly of God, and he was Calvary Baptist. And they never worshiped together. And, you know, that's something to take into consideration, is how do you want to spend your life? Either one of you is going to go to church and the other one is not, and you're going to spend your life going separate directions in a very, very important part of your life. Or, in this case, it could even be that he says, I'm not giving up my church. And she says, I'm not giving up my church. So they spend literally the rest of their lives getting up on Sunday morning and going to separate churches. Well, he says, not the worst thing in the world. I can promise you one thing, it's not the best. I'm so glad that my wife is here today and not down the road at another church. I'm so glad she gets up every Sunday morning and says, I get to hear you preach today, and said, I don't know what you're preaching on, but I'm going to go hear Pastor so-and-so. He's always good. It's a blessing to have your family worshiping together. It's a blessing to know that your family is on track to serve God and to go to heaven. That's a blessing. Now see how much sermon I can get out of this theory? It just makes you wish it was true. And it might be, I don't know. But the problem with this theory, as well as the problem with the theory of the rulers, is that it said the sons of God married the daughters of men, and they had children. And there were giants in those days. And every scholar who reads this, every reputable scholar, the predominant theory, understanding of this is that the giants were the offspring of the marriage of the sons of God and daughters of the men, whoever they were. Whoever they were, these creatures began to be born. It doesn't make sense to me that rulers, commoners, marrying rulers, produces giants. And I've seen a lot of sinners marry Christians, and I haven't seen the first evidence of any Nephilim being born. So the spiritual incompatibility doesn't produce miscreants, giants. The only one that explains the giants is the theory of the angels, which it's difficult to get by that stronghold of saying, but angels just can't procreate. If that's the one you're having a struggle getting by, then you probably will never buy into the angel theory. I just quickly researched. I saw Dr. Michael Brown. I really like Dr. Michael Brown. He speaks to a lot of social issues today. If you have any way of researching him, if you have the internet, if you can Google Dr. Michael Brown, he is rock solid. As a matter of fact, if it's a reference point for anybody, how many of you remember the Pensacola Revival? And I think you went down to it, didn't you? Did anybody else here go down to that Pensacola Revival? Yeah, some of you went down there. Dr. Michael Brown was in a part of that revival because they had recruited him to teach classes as the revival went on, day after day and week after week, and they were putting together activities to go along the revival, along with the revival. Dr. Michael Brown was a part of teaching classes to try and disciple people. So that's how far back that goes. But a brilliant man, and he spoke to this issue, and he is a Old Testament scholar. That's where his emphasis is. So the Old Testament scholar reads this and he says he believes the sons of God to be angels. Now, where he has a problem is some people who believe the sons of God to be angels begins to tie that into extraterrestrial beings, aliens. And he says, I don't go there. He said, that's too far off base. But he said, it does appear as though the intermarriage of angels and human beings created something. And then you go over to Numbers and Deuteronomy and Joshua, and you see the existence of giants in the land. They're coming up to the promised land, and they take a peek in, and say, whoo, you should have seen those people. They're giants. And there are people that are referred to as Anakims. Nephilims and Anakims is the way many people pronounce that. We have Nephilim and Anakims, but Anakims is another race of people that trace back to Anak, who is believed to be a descendant of the Nephilim. But the problem is, they were all wiped out with the flood. Let's see what Genesis says. Let me go back to the book of Genesis here. There were Nephilim in those days, and also afterward, verse 4. There were Nephilim on the earth in those days, and also afterward. After what? After the flood. In those days before the flood, and there were Nephilim after the flood. And the Bible says, when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them, and those proved to be heroes of old, men of great renown, which doesn't mean that they were respectable people, but the deeds that they did, whatever these Nephilim did, was so notorious that it went down as a major significant event in the history of the world, that the Nephilim were, whatever it was notorious. It was well known. It was recorded. And it said, giants in those days and giants afterward, after the flood. So they could not have been really descendants of the Nephilim before the flood, because that's one reason, if you buy into the angel theory, that God wiped out the population. Because now you were at risk of losing that pure bloodline from Adam and Eve to who? Jesus. And you didn't want a mixture in that bloodline to taint that. It had to be the first Adam through to the second Adam, untainted by any kind of other genetic introduction. And we see that as an effort of the enemy to poison the bloodline of Jesus from the first Adam. So if that was the whole purpose of angels intermarrying the daughters of men, and they begin to create these creatures, and God says, I'm not going to let this happen. We're not going to lose the bloodline. And he saved Noah, who was in the lineage, and spared him and his family, and washed the rest of the earth clean. But Satan's not done yet. He says, well, it, It worked pretty good the first time. We just fell a little bit short, but I'm going to try it again. So it says, in those days and afterward, again, sons of God married the daughters of men. And there were giants. And God used Israel and a shepherd boy named David to eradicate the second outgrowth, spontaneous outcropping of giants. Now, that's, as you can see already, where I lean. And the next pastor you get, by all odds, may come in and tell you that this is quite simply the line of Cain and the line of Seth. And I urge you not to make any mention of your former pastor. This is just for us, because anybody who believes in this angels theory is considered weird today. And I don't mind being weird, I just want to cause problems for you. Yeah, it really is not widely accepted today. But to my comfort, I have Dr. Michael Brown on my side. We too will stand against the world. Whatever it was, the intermarriage offended God. Whatever it was, that intermarriage created a race of giants. Whatever it was, they did it before the flood. They did it again after the flood. Whatever it was, God stopped it both times, and it has not happened since. All of those things are apparent. Choose your theory. This is like a buffet today. Pick what you like, but be sure and be able to defend it intelligently. And the next question that comes up, which will bring us to the end of our sermon today, is who are these Nephilim? And I may have more or less answered that, but they're mentioned as giants that make people look like grasshoppers, and they are miscreants. And some think because of being a hybrid of human beings and angelic beings, that also had some sort of, that impacted, well, do these people even have souls? Where do they stand as spiritual beings? A lot of theories have sprung out of that, none of which I think are able to be proven. Some people think that when the Nephilim died, they became disembodied spirit and became demons. I'm not buying into that theory necessarily. But what happens when a human being dies? We think we understand what happens when a human being dies. The soul and the spirit goes back to God. The body goes to the ground. There's a resurrection. And the body is transformed, made incorruptible, and reunited with the soul and the spirit. But what happens to a hybrid between an angel and an earthly woman? And we don't know of any scriptural reference to female angels, so that there would be no reference to female angels seeing the sons of men, daughters of God, sons of men. So there's a lot of things to consider in this, a lot of very interesting things. So if angels are all male, and if they do have the ability to recreate, and if they did marry earthly women, and if they did create giants, there's only certain things we know about these Nephilim. They were obviously wiped out once by a flood, and the second time God using Israel to defeat them, completely eradicate them. But they were men of great renown, creatures of great renown. They were definitely the offspring of the sons of God and daughters of men, whoever they are. And their behavior and their actions were worthy of judgment from God. Now we come to the point where it's not just information. We're done with Sunday school class now. Now we're going to go into personal application. And that is, we can learn things from this history. Here's two points that I think they are valuable takeaways from this little portion of Scripture. And that is, we see the progress, as I've already mentioned, of the detrimental effects of sin. We have this account in this short passage of humanity coming to the point of mass rebellion against God. Whoever these sons of God were, whoever these daughters of men were, and however widespread that was, Moses marks this as a point in time when God determined this to be a mass rebellion, it just proliferated. And we see one principle here that God said, I'll bless you and you will populate the earth. And the one unmistakable truth about this is as population increases, guess what else increases? Sin, wickedness. They track together. The more populated the world becomes, the more wicked the world becomes. I had a short encounter with a young man that actually he went to my church when I was in California. And since that time, he's gone, grown, married, gone to college, went to several very liberal-leaning colleges. Some of them were Bible colleges, seminaries. But he came out with a very leftist, liberal mentality. And in this Facebook conversation that we're having, he asserted, because this is the talking points of the liberal mindset, he said, we're getting better in this world. We are improving. Our moral stance is getting better. Now, you understand where I'm coming from? I don't see that whatsoever. I don't see anything getting better. And he just pointed to a few things that where we're making improvements in the 1950s, taxes were up as high as 90%, and now the taxes have been moderated, and a few things. There was a period in time, a very shameful part of the American history, and in other parts of the country where slavery was abounding, and we've abolished slavery, and so therefore we're getting better. So he's making his argument how much better we're getting. I wonder how murdering 56 million unborn children rates as we're getting better. You can selectively look at things in our nation and say we've made improvements there to make an overall judgment at how morally we are a better place, a better world than we've ever been before. It just doesn't fly. But one thing, if you ever hear anybody trying to make that argument, you can at least rest on this notion that Genesis teaches us this thing. If it doesn't teach us anything else, it teaches us this, that the more populated the world becomes, the more wicked it becomes. And we are right now at 7.6 billion people. For most of my life, 6 billion world population was that looming figure for most of my life. Here we are at 4.5, 5 billion. One of these days we're going to be 6 billion people. Can you even imagine it, 6 billion? But just within the past few years, relatively speaking, we hit the 6 billion and we surged up to 7.6 billion. And at the rate, if we continue the rate, which is a little bit slower than it has been, but if we continue at this rate, they are predicting that by the year 2100, we're just, 83 years away, that the world population is going to be 11.2 billion. We are not only at an unprecedented record level of world population. We've never seen this before. Nobody's ever known a world like this. There just doesn't seem to be any indication that we're going to be able to reverse that trend. There doesn't seem to be any indication that without a cataclysmic event, without a nuclear war that just wipes out masses and multitudes, or a disease that it seems like we've got enough handle on the medical side of this, that we're probably not going to see the plague like they did in Europe, the Black Death. We're not going to see these things wipe out millions of people. So it does not appear that we're ever going to see that population of the world start decreasing. It's just going to continue to increase and get worse. I remind you, the more people, the more wicked. I've got grandchildren. And I'm worried about getting enough of God in them that they can stand against all the junk that's going to be pumped into their brain to tell them that right is wrong and wrong is right and left is right and right is left and up is down and all this twisted and perverted stuff that I'm old enough and solid enough, I can figure it out. But for these young, malleable minds who don't have it quite mind quite made up yet, they can grow up with a very twisted and perverted worldview that has nothing to do with God and nothing to do with the Bible. And I'm very concerned about it. When I was growing up, it was not normal for men to marry men and women to marry women. It's still not right, but they are establishing what they call a new normal. And our kids are going to grow up in a world that is taught this is normal. And there's nothing normal about these kind of things. The more the population, the more wicked. So if we're going to go from 7.6 billion to 11.2 billion, just within basically the lifetime of some of my grandchildren, how wicked is that world going to be with 11.2 billion people that continue with the increase of the population of the world, to follow the way of wickedness and depart from God? Is it going to be another Sodom and Gomorrah where God will be able to say, if you just find me 10 righteous people, I'll spare the world. But if you can't, I'm going to destroy it, because God came to a point when he saw the sons of God marrying the daughters of men and developing these angels and the whole world going after this. It's falling apart before his eyes. He said, enough is enough. I'll wipe the world clean. And I've got to ask the question. If we're living in a world today that the greater the population, the greater the wickedness, how close are we to this same God saying to this same world, once again, I've had it with your sinfulness. I've had it with the proliferation of wickedness. Enough is enough. One of these days, when God's finally decided it's all I can stand, and I'm not going to let it go any farther, and he will. One of these days, it's going to happen. And he's going to turn to his son, and he said, it's time. You've got to go take back over. They have destroyed the world. Go take it back. We are standing on the very precipice of the end of the world. If you'll let me use that phrase. We're standing on the very edge of it. I don't know how much longer God can wait. It's not going to get better. Not as long as the population increases. But that's not going to happen. It's getting worse. It's getting worse. It's getting worse. It's getting worse. Now, I don't want to be all doomsday, because it's an opportunity for evangelism like we've never had. You have to have lost people to evangelize. We've got all kinds of opportunity for evangelism. So as bad as it is, we still have to have the hope that people still need God. And some people are still redeemable. Some people are still going to wake up to the fact that there is good news. Some people are going to be disgusted with what's going on in this world. Got a young man sitting in this congregation this morning, and he'll know I'm talking about him, that's telling me about his life story, about coming to the end of, I'm tired of living like this. I'm tired to do these things. I want to turn around. I want to change my life, and made a great change in his life and came to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. And you know, this is not just an isolated thing. There are people who are going to find that there's nothing in this world that satisfies. There's still a craving, hungering, spiritual desire for something that it just doesn't, it's not provided by the world. We have the responsibility to continue to reach the lost until Jesus comes. Bow your heads.